Hello everyone, a very warm welcome back to Q-Talks. I hope all of you are doing pretty good, enjoying the last week, approximately the last week of this new year. And today we are going to dive more into the story of someone who has taken the baton to carry on and spread the awareness in the community out there, especially in respect to the women. But also, it's not only for women, it's related to all of us all together. With this, I would like to welcome Dr. Victoria here on the show. She's a survivor and a mother of a special needs miracle child. With more than 16 years of educating herself and countless others with special needs community, she brings light to those who have known the true darkness. You are most welcome here on Q-Talks.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'm really excited to dive more into the reason behind the work which you're doing today. So maybe let's start from your unique story. What's your unique story has been until now?
My unique story was I had everything I wanted in life, except I didn't have a family. And I really, really wanted a family. I was very successful in my career in the corporate life. And I had a one-bedroom apartment living alone. I had great friends. I was with the love of my life, my soulmate. We broke up and I was heartbroken. Only time in my life I ever rebound. And when I did, I met a narcissistic monster. And he really rushed me into the express lane, if you will, of relationships. I kept saying it's going too fast and things aren't feeling right. And because I traveled with my job, I didn't spend that much time with him. I never stayed at his place. But he kept rushing it and was doing a lot of manipulation and saying, well, we've given so much time to the wrong ones. Why can't we have time for the right ones? Why do we have to wait any longer? Next thing you know, we're married. And shortly thereafter, I'm pregnant. And it was not even a couple of weeks into that that the abuse began. And for me, it was like, that didn't just happen. I know that didn't just happen. I was completely appalled and shocked. And then the abuse continued. Now, I have to say, one hit, one kick, one punch is one too many. It doesn't matter if it was 100 or one in regards to the fact that it's undeserved. I don't care about anything except the fact that it's not deserved and should not be tolerated. So I'm pregnant, and the entire time of my pregnancy, I am getting beaten, assaulted, stabbed, kicked, knocked unconscious, and I was all alone. I kept begging and begging for help and got nowhere, which is very common. I was married to an active military person, if you will. I do know, and I just want to say, I know not all military is bad. Mm-hmm. I want to put that out there. However, I ended up with that bad apple from the tree, and everyone turned a blind eye and helped support him, which is very common in the military. One in three military families have some form of abuse going on. And if you think about that, if that's one in three that's out there and actually, you know, a recorded statistic, what are the real numbers? Because if one in three is reported, how many aren't reporting? Because they're not going to get their justice. They're not going to get the security and safety. And my problem was, if we have military that is supposed to protect people, why aren't they protecting their people on their own soil? Sure. Why aren't you helping? I made it very clear he was going to kill me, and they turned a blind eye. So I ended up in the ICU again. And my daughter came early, and she was life flighted to a remarkable children's hospital where we remained for 6 months. She has had 34 surgeries. She is amazing. She's the most miracle, God-giving gift anyone could ever ask for. I've had over 100 surgeries to correct the abuse that I had to endure. When I got out, I was in a wheelchair, and I literally fought everyone. I was in a fight unlike anything anyone's ever known. I was fighting the military. I was fighting him. I was fighting to get the rights terminated so he couldn't be anywhere alone with my child. I was fighting for a divorce. I was fighting for my own health. But number one, I was fighting for my daughter. And when I was watching her code and have seizures every single day, it is something that a parent should never have to see. Something a mother or a father should never have to see. And by the grace of God and the will to fight, we're both here today. And I have used my voice and my platform to help other special needs families realize of the services and therapies and other things that they deserve they might not be aware of. I help advocate for them in like the IEP process of school to make sure their children get the education that they need. I also go and advocate for the domestic violence survivors. There are men, there are women. It happens to all of us. It does happen more frequently to women, but it does happen to men. And so I advocate for them as well and help bring awareness to some of the red flags people might not see. And that is what we have been doing. I've been doing it now over 17 years. And I published my memoir 2017-ish called Who Kicked First? And it's the gospel truth of what happened. The only thing that was changed in the book are names and geographic locations for security and safety. And now I just try to help pay it forward because I don't want anyone to go through what I went through and not have someone by their side to tell them that they're worth fighting for, that they have that within them. You can't let the abuser take everything away from you. They cannot have that kind of control. And if you're not alone and you realize that you have someone in your corner, you can get through it.
Yeah, for sure. It helps you and gives you confidence that if somebody is beside you in that journey, right? First and foremost, I would like to say this again that, of course, I said it before too, before the show, but again, that you're a brave woman and you're a brave person who took this season and fought everything by yourself, because I'm just imagining now like how all these things has happened, and it's not only you after your daughter has been here on the earth, then it's two lives, and then you need to fight for two lives. And being yourself not in that situation, but being in the fighter mode is like really good. And I always say it's good to be into the fighting mode instead of being a victim mode, because victim mode lead us to feel as a victim, of course, and then draw our energy instead of boosting our energy, which is being into the fighting mode. But I have a few questions here coming. For example, that your husband at that time was from the military, right? So how does the military people at that time, they really reacted and responded to the situation when you reported it?
Well, excuse me, to be honest with you, like I said, and I just want to reiterate, I know that not all military is bad. But I went to his command the first time. And as you can see, I'm very fair. And I was very obviously, I had a huge black eye. And I asked hypothetically, what would happen if a soldier was beating his wife? And I put my sunglasses up to the top of my head at that point, and you can see that I had this really big black eye, and it was, oh, we take care of our soldiers. We're not going to allow that. We're not going to tolerate it. And I felt, oh, relief. Okay, great. This is, you know, going to stop. This is going to end. No, he came home from work. He came back to the house because it wasn't a home. He came back to the house that night, and I got beat again for going and doing what I did, which was to seek assistance. And then I went to the family advocacy center on the base asking for help. And I am methodical when it comes to keeping proof and evidence and things of that nature, because the one thing a battered individual has is their word. And what's unfair is that we are put on the spot to prove what we went through when it should be the accused that should be proving whether they're guilty or innocent. But when you yourself are literally covered in bruises and things are broken, you've got enough evidence on your person. And literally, they kept changing the subject. They turned a blind eye. He actually broke my nose on the military base, and they did nothing. They literally didn't do a thing. So I went above that chain of command. I went above them and still got the same kind of response. And I made it clear he was going to kill me. So I kept bringing proof. And they were like, why do you have so much proof of this? You know, it's incredibly strange that you have so many documents stating this abuse. Like, why? And I said, because nobody's listening. And I want it made very clear that if he does kill me, I don't want him to get my child. I want to make sure that it's very clear he doesn't get her. Mm-hmm. So I kept proof. And it wasn't a he said, she said, which is very frequent in this situation. It was my photographs coinciding with my medical records that the civilian doctors made. The civilian doctors would talk to the military and say, we just set her nose. We just set her jaw. We just set her shoulder. You know, we just stitched up another stabbing. You need to do something because it's their soldier, and literally nothing. And so it just kept escalating and escalating and escalating until I went to the civilian sector myself, and they immediately acted. And due to the technicality of it's just so frustrating that the military, police, and the CID are supposed to work together to do an investigation and then decide what charges are to be pressed, if you will. Then they're supposed to reach out to the outside law enforcement community and work with them. And That's not how this went. And I've never been involved with the military prior. I was not a previous military wife or soldier myself. So who would know these things? And I kept going to the military and I kept getting nowhere. So I went to the outside sector. They arrested him and incarcerated him. We went to the bindover hearing and he was released on a technicality. And he was basically let go. He was free and clear. And I couldn't believe it. So he got away with everything.
Okay. And at the first point, when you were going like to the hospitals, because in the military base, we are also having the hospitals inside the base too, right? Mm-hmm. So you were not reporting there. You were going outside, or?
I was having my OBGYN outside.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And when he would do major damage, he took me to the military hospital. And they have buddies there and they would trade favors and mm-hmm. I would get stitched up off the books. I would, you know, and I never took any pain meds because I didn't want them to affect the baby. So
they ask you the questions like, how does it happen? And
no, not when you know everybody and then you're on a small base, because this was a smaller little dinky. And I don't mean dinky as in like, you know, I meant like dinky as in size, like size wise. And that, you know, you get, hey, I'll do you a solid. I'll take care of this for you if you take care of this for me. And people just said, oh, you're really clumsy, you know, and, you know, you just keep getting hurt all the time. And they tried to say I had no medical record at the hospital when I summoned records. They tried to say, no, she has no medical record. She's never seen at this hospital. Well, not true, because he made me go get sonograms there because he wanted a son. And when he found out it was a daughter, mm-hmm. I got beaten because he thought that was my fault, that I chose the sex of the baby, which is not true. Men choose the sex of the baby, but that I somehow mysteriously made the baby go from a boy to a girl. And so he took me to the military and had me have a sonogram. Well, I got the pictures and it had my name on it. But when I went to court, they testified that I was never, ever a patient of that hospital. And my attorney said, are you sure? Nope, never, never, ever. Well, how do you explain this? Oh, and again, you know, it was just nonstop rhetoric, which when you're going through something of this magnitude, you shouldn't have to keep proving your point. Like I said, you don't have surgery for something that's not broken. And how do you explain, like, you know, I was strangled and suffocated, and we have pictures where his thumbs were on my throat and the side of his hands were around my neck. Well, they tried to say that I did it to myself. Well, you take your own hands and put them around here. How's your thumb going to get right here on both? You can't. It's physically impossible. Well, they actually took the measurements of the bruising and the sides of it was some kind of forensic thing. And they actually measured and found out it was his. Well, yeah. And then I went so far as he would brag about it all the time. So I literally started to have a wire where I was recording, and he admitted to everything. Absolutely. He'd brag about it. He would brag about it. You see what I get away with? You see what I can get away with you? Nobody's going to care. Nobody's going to miss you when I, you know, take you out, which is a military term. I'm going to take you out and nobody's going to know. Nobody will miss you. And I realized this is a fight or flight. This is as real as it gets.
Yeah, that situation is really tough. And when the people are not beside you, or at least nobody is like here, they're out to listen to the situation as it is. Now let's fast forward. Now, so that incident happened like approximately how long ago? Like 10 years?
17 or? Years.
17 years. Okay. And the work which you are doing today, in that moment, who were those people who were with you, and from where you got this confidence, firstly, and the courage to start the journey of the work you are doing today?
I didn't have the courage and the self-esteem, I'll tell you that. I thought I was a monster because I had, everywhere I looked were scars from him and scars from surgeries. But I looked at my daughter and said, she deserves the real me. She deserves the mom that is going to fight like I have. And she didn't do anything wrong. And 100% that child is mine. That's not his. It never was. That is all my child. And I've never looked at her and thought, that's part of, no, I can't finish a sentence because it's not, it's, she's mine. So I immediately started advocating because I was learning when your daughter is in a medically induced coma, because they had to put in a tracheostomy to help her breathe. And when she's in a medically induced coma, you can't stimulate her because it could cause her to move very suddenly, and with a fresh trach and fresh ties and stitches, you have to be ever so careful. So I was learning. I was sitting there learning everything and anything I can. And so I was learning about like the services that she needed. I started learning sign language so that she could, because when you're trached, unless you have a passive mirror valve cap on, you're not audible. So how can she convey to me what she needs? So I started learning sign. I ended up starting to teach her sign where she could tell me that she needed something. And I started learning about all of these programs, all of these therapies. How can I get her over this obstacle, if you will, that's in front of us? How can I make her better? She doesn't deserve this life. So what can I do to make this better? So I started doing that. And then I would see families that were going through the same thing about these beautiful children that didn't know that they could have services at their home, or, you know, how do you go into school and fight for their educational rights instead of just stick them in a corner somewhere and receive the funding for them? So I got certified in all of this training and I started advocating and helping. I had a nurse come to me and say, you know, when your daughter was life-flighted here, it came with her as to why she came early. So we know. And with that, you know, all of those people are still with us today. And they're now not only the medical team, but their family, their actual family. And one of her doctors is my daughter's godmother. And so she said, I have a dear friend who is going through something similar. Would you talk to her? Never thought about it. Never thought about doing anything like that. I didn't want to talk about it. Yeah. And I said, absolutely. If I can help, I will. And I did. And now she's a nurse. She's thriving. She's amazing. And she said, I would have never gotten out if you hadn't helped. And I said, I don't want the credit. I just gave you the way to do it. I mean, it was just, you did the work. I just kind of provided instruction. I don't ever want the credit. You are so much stronger than you know. And it's from within. And maybe you just need a little help getting it out. And so that's what I want everybody to know, is that I'm there to help get that out. So that's what we do. And that's how it all became how it is. I went to court, and my ex, who was my love of my life and my soulmate, went with me to court. They hated one another. And he was a officer, the police officer. And we are now married. The officer and I are married, and he's adopted my daughter. And so it's amazing. And so we work to help others. That's what all we do. That's what I do now.
That's awesome. That's really an awesome journey, and the awesome way you have tackled the things, and the way you you come out of the situation and then you grow through the situation. And then the service point is really, really an amazing. But let's say for an example, which I most of the time think is at the very first, that at the very, very starting, when we realize that it's not going the way we want it to go, for example, the relationship, then why, of course, it's very subjective question, that why most of the people prefer to stay into that situation instead of just taking that leap and coming out of that environment?
That is such an amazing, great question. I'm so glad that you asked that, because a lot of people don't understand that the hardest time to get out of a relationship is when you're trying to. And on average, most people return 6 or 7 times to their abuser, and it's because they aren't prepared. They're not ready. You have to have a safety plan in place. I actually help get you safer at home in the interim until you are able to get out. You are financially held by your abuser. A lot of times they control the finances. They control where you go, who you talk to, where you've been. So it's quite the challenge, but it's not something you can't achieve. So I have a lot of times, a lot of people will say, why did you stay? You know, or you deserved it because you stayed. And that's not the case at all. If you don't have a clue where you're going to go, or you don't have, you know, the resources because this is going on, and you know that you're not going to be in a safe place, then you're safer there in their mind until you've put together an action plan, until you put together a safety plan. Because honestly, if you call the police out, the way it is now, they have to physically see the incident transpire before anyone is incarcerated. It's not like, you know, they do bring in the 2 officers, but it is a domestic violence call that is the most dangerous call for a police officer to respond to. And normally there's 2 officers, and one takes the female, one takes the male, and they get their side of the story, and then they change, and then they speak to see who and what is being said. But if you get a restraining order on them, it's only going to tick off the perpetrator. And that's, to be honest, I don't want to sugarcoat anything and say, yeah, go get a restraining order. Yes, I do suggest that you get one, but understand that all you're going to do is make them angry, because a piece of paper is not going to stop them if they are already at the level that they're at. You need to get your act in order. You need to get your safety plan together. I can help facilitate that. I have access to places for people. I even have mover companies that will move you for free. I have the coalitions in every state. You know, we really work, and we're with you every step of the way. It's not just in the beginning. It is through the entire process. And all of the people I've assisted, I'm so happy to say that I've become friends with. And we still are friends to this day, because it is a community. And people need to realize, nobody just raises their hand and says, hey, I want to be in a relationship where I get beaten. Nobody does that. That's no true. One. And so no one deserves it, and no one should stay for it. You have to be able to get out, and you have to be able to survive. And the opportunity of the higher physical violence comes from when you're trying to leave. And so you have to make sure that you have everything ready so that you can get out and that you can stay out.
Is this a reason that it comes when you're trying to leave the highest level of domestic violence? Because firstly, the another person might be himself or herself is not feeling secured, or not being to accept like what he or she is in reality. And the another reason can be that if you go out and share the things, of course, it can hamper his or her professional life or personal life. Do you think like these 2 reasons can be the one that's why this happens? I mean, I'm just thinking from...
Right,
from...
No, right. A part of the way, yes, an abuser has cycles where in the beginning, they're that charming, charismatic person that finds you and then puts you on a pedestal and loves to brag about you and do everything with you, and then starts to come down into the humiliation process. But when you go through, there's a 4 cycle period, but when they think that you're leaving, they're losing that control. They're losing that power over you. And they try to make you believe you can't do anything without them. You'll never be good enough without them. Nobody else will want you because they're the only ones who will ever take you. You should feel bad for them because they're stuck with someone like you. And they turn around and it's like the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde syndrome, where they're one way in front of people and another way behind closed doors. And it's more of the, like when they're out and about, they're courting, if you will, their next target, where they're being nice and sweet and charming to lure them in. And that's how they do that. But when you try to get out, everything that he or she has turned you into, if you will, you know, like where I would come home and I knew that dinner had to be on the table at a very certain time. I knew that none of the food could touch each other because his OCD would go ballistic. I knew that, you know, I couldn't do X, Y, and Z. I knew that the clothes had to be put away and the bed had to be made a certain way. And if it wasn't, then this would happen. So training you or training the individual and then seeing them leave, he almost has to start back at square one. If he loses you and gets you out of the equation, then he has to go find somebody else. So that's when the violence escalates at that point.
And so you mentioned like the four cycles of the abusing relationship. So can you please put more light on these four cycles?
Sure. Well, you have that charming, like I said, charismatic person who just makes you like my ex, and you know, he was not attractive physically. And I've said that, you know, and that wasn't being mean or cruel. I mean, everybody's attracted to who they're attracted to. And, but it was his inside and the way he presented himself, like he knew I wanted a family. And so he took that key and he ran with it. You know, I've always wanted a family and I've always been overseas and over here, and I never could settle down and have a family, which is what I want, which is what I wanted. You know, and then he's saying the same thing. So it allures you in that way. He finds your weakness and he plays it. So you have that. And then it's the let's rush, rush, rush. So he can start isolating you from everybody else, whether it's living together, rushing you into marriage. It's basically rushing you into an isolated state so that control can begin. Then becomes the abuse, where that starts. In the beginning, we're all dumbfounded, like this didn't just happen. I can't believe this just happened. No way. And then it was, well, why did you make me do that? If you had just done what I told you to do, I wouldn't have had to do this. Do you think I enjoy doing this to you? I don't. Why do you make me do this? And we get brainwashed and we really start to begin to believe, maybe if I had just done this, then he wouldn't have done it. Maybe this is my fault. Maybe if I had just got the laundry done sooner, he wouldn't be mad that the clothes aren't put away yet. Well, we can't speed up a washer. We can't speed up a dryer. If the clothes aren't done, that's not in our control. So, you know, it's the guilt trip that's put onto us about, well, if you had just done what you were supposed to do, I don't want to do this to you. Why do you make me do this? And then they get up and leave because they are showing that they're ashamed, but they're not. They're trying to brainwash you and manipulate you even more. And then they turn around and they go back into that very sweet mode when they're worried that maybe you're starting to realize what is really going on and transpiring. And they try to be that charming person again long enough to kind of get away from all of those questionable doubts you're starting to have. Like, I don't need to be here. I need to get out. And then he's like, you know what, babe? Let's go out for dinner. Let's just go somewhere, just the two of us. And then that romantic, charming side comes back on. You know, maybe he sets you a bubble bath or gives you some flowers or something. You know, I'm so sorry for what I did. I feel horrible. It'll never happen again. And then 24, 48, 72 hours later, it happens again. And it's, well, if you had just done what I told you to do, like if the remote batteries are dead, how do we know that? Not all remotes are going to show low battery, right? Well, I used to get the remote shoved into my face from a distance because the battery was dead. How would I know that they were dead? I don't get to sit and watch television. I was always keeping the house immaculate. I was doing this, I was doing that. So it was, why did you make me do that? And if the remote broke, that's my fault. I didn't throw it. I didn't chuck it at your face. He chucked it at mine. But because it broke, that would be my fault too. And then, you know, you have to go out and get me a new one right now. Like, I'm not going to be out a remote control. Go. And then if you kept extra batteries, well, you should throw the batteries away before it gets weak so that this won't happen again. And then you do that and it's, well, why are you wasting good batteries? Why are you throwing away good batteries? You're wasting my money. You can't win. You just can't win.
But
so
if
you
something related to, so sorry for the interruption then.
Oh, no.
Is it something related to the that the another person should go and look to the psych or look to look for some kind of help, because that person himself or herself is not able to in a stable situation and not able to take a stable and critical decision.
They don't believe that they need help. They don't believe they've done anything wrong. And what's so ironic is that those of us that do go to therapy, which I tell anyone who's been through this, absolutely need to have someone to talk to. The ones that go to therapy are the ones that are sent to therapy. The ones that need therapy are the ones that refuse to go. Like, they don't think that they've done anything wrong, so they don't want to go and get any help. They don't foresee that there's anything wrong with them.
Okay. Yeah.
But they're too egotistical. They're too narcissistic. You know, they don't want to hear anything because there's nothing negative about them. They're perfect in their own head, and they don't want to go and be told that, why are you doing this? You know, what's making you do this to her or him? Because that makes them accountable for their actions, and they will never take accountability for what they've done.
Okay. Yeah. This is something which I also, as I said to you before, episode, it's really important for us as a human being to take the responsibility and the accountability, firstly towards us and then towards our near and dear ones, which can include friends, families, and the society and whatsoever.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a bit pitchy. Yeah, but I guess that now the people might get much better and understand that what is their essence in their life firstly, and then the life of other people with whom they are together in this life.
Right. Absolutely.
So now, before we move on towards the outro questions for today's episode, what's your advice or what's your suggestion for someone who is into this type of situation and how they can come out of that? Of course, individually, it might differ case to case, right?
Absolutely.
But what's your opinion and what's your suggestion and advice there?
The first thing I would do is see where you are in the situation. There are things that you can do. If there are children involved, that's a whole different show. If there are children involved, make sure that when, and the person knows when it's going to get to that level, get away from the kids. Because if the kids try to stop, don't hurt mommy, don't hurt daddy, then the aggressor is going to start on the children. So get away from the kids. Tell them no matter what, stay in your room, shut the door, don't come out and try to help. Always try to be in a central area of a room. Don't try to be in a corner. Don't get in a corner, because then he can or she can trap you in the corner. I tell everybody, don't go to the top of the stairs because they can shove you down the stairs. There are simple things that you can do that can make this transition a little less violent, if you will, because they're going to do what they're going to do. And, you know, if you know that, there's things that you can do in the process. I took every single knife out of the kitchen and made sure that there were no knives in the kitchen, because I was stabbed over a dozen times. And that, I took those away. If there's any glasses, put them away, get plastic, throw away ones from the dollar store. Get those, put those in there. If he has a tendency or she has a tendency to throw glasses or plates or whatever, change them and get the plastic. If there are kitchen cooking utensils and they're like stainless steel, go to the dollar store, get plastic. If you're going to get hit with something and it's going to happen, plastic is a little less painful than the stainless steel. It's going to happen. It's going to happen until we can get you out. But there are steps that you can make. Don't be upstairs. Don't be in a bathroom, because a bathroom is a smaller area. It has lots of availability to put you in a situation where you could really get hurt. So that is the first step, is trying to make things safer and safer little by little in order to transition to safety. And always make sure that the kids are safe. Make sure that they're not right there and that they're going to see it, because you're also teaching these kids that it's okay to treat your significant other that way or your siblings that way, because that's what they're learning is how to be treated. Because our job as parents is to help our children get to the next stage of life and show them it's okay to be treated this way. It's not okay to be treated this way. We need to teach them what is okay and not okay, because both of them, girl or boy, are learning it's okay to have this done by a man. It's okay to have this done by a woman. And it's not. You need to stop the cycle. You've got to break the cycle.
Yeah, the last point which you mentioned about the kids is something which I also align on that. Of course, I am aligned on other points too, but especially on the kids one, because then it's not only you, between you both, but then it's the next generation or the family too. And then it's connected to the another life too. So it's like a chain, you know.
The domino effect.
Exactly. And it's important not to get someone fall into this domino effect, in this case with the kids, because when we are growing up as a kids, what we see first and foremost is the parents.
Yes.
They are the first teachers which we are having.
Yes.
It has been really nice to talk to you, and thanks a lot for sharing your story and the work you are doing. And now we will move towards the outro questions part. And the very first question is, what inspires you the most?
Everybody. People inspire me every day. My daughter is a huge inspiration in my life to see everything she's overcome and everything that they said she'd never do, she's done. And that's a huge inspiration. Special needs children are so inspirational to me when I get to work with them and I see the growth. And, you know, it doesn't matter if a car cuts us off as an adult, people get in a bad mood, and then things just, you know, people let the littlest things bother you. But you will never find an unhappy special needs kiddo. They are the sweetest, biggest hearted kids you'll ever meet. And they don't take anything for granted. They live their life and they love life, and they just are so happy. And that right there is an inspiration. If you're going to complain that they were out of your coffee creamer or you got cut off, go look at one of these beautiful children that fight 7 days a week, 24 hours a day to breathe, to eat, to just walk, and then tell me how upset you are that your creamer was out.
Yeah, that's really a good point, because most often we forget that what we are having today on the table for us, maybe few of the people are deprived of that. And when we see them smiling and happy on what they have got, is really a good source of motivation and inspiration that I truly aligned. Yeah. Going to the next question is, what are you most grateful for in your life?
I am most grateful to God that I'm here and I survived with a 2% chance of survival. I am so grateful for my amazing family, my daughter and my amazing husband, my best friend, my soulmate, that we have overcome every one of those odds and obstacles, no matter what has been put in front of us, and that we are doing our work, which is advocating and using our voice as our platform.
Wow. And especially the last point is like really wonderful, the work which you're doing.
Thank you.
Really nice job. And then going to the last question is, which is the single best piece of advice you have ever received in your life until now?
I have to say it's actually a piece of advice that I normally say when I'm doing speaking engagements, because it really does resonate and it really gets a reaction. As I tell everybody, when you're at your darkest moment, I want you to remember one thing. You have survived 100% of your worst days. 100%. So no matter how bad the worst day of your life was, you survived it. And the worst is behind us and we're moving forward. And if you could survive 100% of your worst days, we're going to get through this.
Wow. That's really deep inside. Touch me, because this morning I was also thinking, this thought came to me because I was listening to a podcast and there he also said like, whatever happened yesterday has happened and you have survived that, and today is a new day. Mm-hmm. And how do you take it today is the most important point.
Yes.
So it has been really nice talking to you, and I am really glad to this, firstly for this connection we have, and then to have you here on the show.
Well, thank you for
a lot for your time. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
And thanks a lot for everybody out there for listening to this episode. All the handles for Victoria are available below in this description of this episode. So you can directly go through them and get in touch with her. She's an amazing person.
Thank you.
And until next time, everybody out there, stay healthy, stay happy, and most important, stay amazing. Ciao, tschüss, and goodbye.